This is Audible.
Necroscope 5, Deadspawn. Written by Brian Lumley. Narrated by Michael Troughton. Chapter 1, Charnel Knowledge.
Harry?
Darcy Clark's voice was twitchy on the phone, but he was trying hard to contain it.
There's a problem we could use some help with. Your kind of help.
Harry Keogh, Necroscope, might or might not know what was bothering the head of E Branch, and it might or might not have to do with him directly. "What is it, Darcy?" he said, speaking softly.
"It's murder,"
the other answered, and now his twitchiness came on strong, shaking his voice.
"It's bloody awful murder, Harry. By God, I never saw anything like it."
Darcy Clark had seen a lot in his time, and Harry Keogh knew it, so that this was a statement he found hard to believe. Unless, of course, Clark was talking about "my kind of help," you said. Harry's attention was suddenly riveted to the phone. "Darcy, are you trying to tell me that..."
"What?"
The other didn't understand him at first, but then he did.
"No! Oh, no! Christ, no! It's not the work of a vampire, Harry, but some kind of monster, certainly. Oh, human enough, but a monster, too."
Harry relaxed a bit, but a very little. He'd been expecting a call from E Branch sooner or later. This could be it. Some sort of clever trap, except Darcy had always been his friend. Harry didn't think he would act on something, not even something like that, without checking it out every which way first. And even then, Harry couldn't see Darcy coming after him with a crossbow and hardwood bolt, a machete, a can of petrol. No, he'd have to talk to him first, get Harry's side of it. But in the end, the head of the branch knew almost as much about vampires now as Harry did, and he'd known, too, that there was no hope. They'd been friends, fighting on the same side, so Harry guessed it wouldn't be Darcy's finger on the trigger, but someone's, certainly.
"Harry?"
Clark was anxious.
"Are you there?"
"Where are you, Darcy?" Harry inquired.
"The military police duties room in the castle,"
the other answered at once.
"They found her body under the wall. Just a kid, Harry. 18 or 19. They don't even know who she is yet. That alone would be a big help. But to know who did it would be the biggest bonus of all."
If there was one man Harry Keogh could trust, it had to be Darcy Clark. "Give me 15 minutes, he said, "and I'll be there." Clark sighed.
"Thanks, Harry. We'd appreciate it."
"We?" Harry snapped. He couldn't keep the suspicion out of his voice.
"Eh?"
Clark sounded startled, taken aback.
"Why, the police and me."
Murder? The police? Not a branch job at all. So what was Clark doing on it? If it was real. "How did you get roped in?" And suddenly the other was caught on the hop. Cagey, anyway.
I was up here on a duty run, visiting an old Scottish auntie. Something I do once in a blue moon. She's been on her last legs for 10 years now, but won't lie down, keeps on tottering around. I was scheduled to go back down to HQ today, but then this came up. It's something the branch has been trying to help the police with. A set of, God, gruesome serial murders, Harry."
An old Scottish auntie. It was the first time Harry had heard of Darcy's old auntie. On the other hand, this had to be a good opportunity to find out if they knew anything about his problem. Harry knew he would have to be careful. He knew too much about E Branch to just go walking into something. Yes, and they knew too much about him. But maybe they didn't know everything. Not yet, anyway.
"Harry?"
Clark's voice came back again, tinny and a little distorted, probably the wires swaying in the winds that invariably blew around the castle's high walls.
"Where will I see you?"
"On the esplanade at the top of the Royal Mile," the Necroscope growled. "And Darcy?"
"Yes?"
"Nothing. We'll talk later." He replaced the telephone in its cradle, went back to his breakfast in the kitchen. An inch-thick steak, raw and bloody. To look at, Darcy Clark was probably the world's most nondescript man. Nature had made up for this physical anomaly, however, by giving him an almost unique talent. Clark was a deflector. He was the opposite of accident-prone. Only let him get close to danger and something, some parapsychological guardian angel, would intervene on his behalf. Which meant that if all Clark's similarly ESP-talented team of psychics were photographs, he'd be the only negative. He had no control over the thing. He was only ever aware of it on those occasions when he stared deliberately in the face of danger. The talents of others, telepathy, screeing, foretelling, onomancy, lie-detecting, were more pliable, obedient, applicable. But not Clark's. It just did its own thing, which was to look after him. It had no other use. But because it ensured his longevity, it made him the right man for the job. The anomaly was this, that he himself didn't quite believe in it until he felt it working. He still switched off the current before he even changed a light bulb, but maybe that was just another example of the thing at work. To look at him then, no one would suppose that Clark could ever be the boss of anything, let alone head of the most secret branch of the British Secret Services. Middle height, mousy-haired, with something of a slight stoop and a small paunch, and middle-aged to boot, he was middling in just about every way. He had sort of neutral hazel eyes, in a face not much given to laughter, and an intense mouth which you might remember if you remembered nothing else. But other than that, there was a general facelessness about him which made him instantly forgettable. The rest of him, including the way he dressed, was medium. These were Harry Keogh's perfectly mundane thoughts in the few seconds which ticked by after he stepped out of the metaphysical Mobius Continuum onto the esplanade of Edinburgh Castle and saw Darcy Clark standing there with his back to him, hands thrust deep in the pockets of his overcoat, reading the legend of a brass plaque above a 17th-century drinking trough. The iron fountain, picturing two heads, one ugly and the other beatific, stood. Near the site on which many witches were burned at the stake, the wicked head and serene head signifies that some used exceptional knowledge for evil purposes, while others were misunderstood and wished their kind nothing but good. The bright May day would be warm but for the gusting wind. The esplanade was almost empty. 2 dozen or so tourists stood in small groups at the higher end of the broad walled tarmac plateau, looking down across the walls of the city or taking photographs of the great grey fortress, the castle on the rock, behind its facade of battlements and courtyards. Harry, who had arrived in the moment after Clark, vainly scanned the esplanade for some sign of him and turned to the plaque. A moment ago, Clark had been alone with his thoughts and no living person within 50 feet of him, but now a soft voice behind him said, "Fire is an indiscriminate destroyer. Good or evil, everything burns when it's hot enough." Clark's heart jumped into his throat. He gave a massive start and whirled around, the colour rushing from his face and leaving him pale in a moment. "Harry!" he gasped. "God, I didn't see you. Where did you spring?" But here he paused, for of course he knew where Harry had sprung from, because the necroscope had taken him there once, into the everywhere and when place that within and without, which was the Mobius Continuum. Shaken, heart hammering, Clark clutched at the wall for support, but it wasn't terror, just shock. His talent read no sinister purpose into Keogh's presence. Harry smiled at him and nodded, touched his arm briefly, then looked at the plaque again, and his smile at once turned sour. "Mainly, they were exercising their own fears," he said, "for of course most, if not all, of these women were innocent. Indeed, we should all be so innocent." "Eh?" Clark hadn't quite recovered his balance yet, wasn't focusing on Keogh's meaning. "Innocent?" He too looked at the plaque. "Completely." Harry nodded again. "Oh, they may have been talented in their way, but they were hardly evil." "Witchcraft? Why, today you'd probably try to recruit them into E-Branch." Suddenly, truth flooded in on Clark, and he knew he wasn't dreaming. No need to pinch himself and start awake. It was just this effect which Harry always had on him. 3 weeks ago in the Greek islands, was that all it had been, 3 weeks? It had been the same, except at that time Harry had been near impotent. He didn't have his dead speak. Then he'd got it back and set out on his double mission to destroy the vampire Janos Forenzi and regain his mastery of... Clark snatched a breath.
You got it back! He grabbed Harry's arm. The Mobius Continuum!
You didn't get in touch with me, Harry accused, however quietly. Or you'd have known.
I have your letter, Clark quickly defended himself, and tried a dozen times to get you on the phone. But if you were at home, you weren't answering. My locators couldn't find you.
He threw up his arms.
Give me a chance, Harry. I've only been back from the Med a few days, and a pile of stuff to catch up with back here, too. But we'd finished a job in the islands, and we'd supposed you'd done the same at your end. Our espers were on it, of course. Reports were coming in. Janus's place above Halmajou, blown off the mountain like that. It could only be you. We knew you'd somehow won. But the Mobius Continuum, too. Why, that's wonderful. I'm delighted for you.
Harry wondered. Oh, really? But out loud, he only said, thanks.
How in the hell did you do that?
Clark was still excited. If it was all a sham, he was good at it.
I mean, wreck the castle that way. If we got it right, it was devastating. Is that how Janos died, in the explosion?
Slow down, Harry told him, taking his arm. We can talk while you take me to see this girl. The other's excitement quickly ebbed.
Yes, he nodded, his tone subdued now. And that's something else, too. You won't like it, Harry.
So what's new? The necroscope seemed as calm, resigned, soulful, sardonic as ever, and though he tried not to show it, Clark suspected he was wary too.
Did you ever show me anything I did like? But Clark had an answer to that one. If everything was the way you'd like it, Harry, he said, then we'd all be out of work. Me, I'd gladly retire tomorrow. I keep threatening to, but when I see something like I'm going to show you, then I know that someone has to do it.
As they started up the esplanade, Harry said, Now, this is a castle. His voice was more animated now. But as for the Castle Forenzi, that was a heap long before I got started on it. You asked how I did it. He sighed, then continued. A long time ago, towards the end of the Badescu affair, I learned about an ammo and explosives dump in Colomia and used stuff from there to blow up the Chateau Brunizzi. Well, since the easy way is often the best, I did it again. I made two or three trips, Mobius trips, and put enough plastic explosive in the foundations of Janus's place to blow it to hell. I'm not even going to guess what was in the guts of that place, but I'm sure there was stuff there which even I didn't see and still don't want to. You know, Darcy, even a finger end of Semtex will blow bricks right out of a wall, so you can imagine what a couple of hundredweight will do. If there was anything there that we might call alive, he shrugged and shook his head, it wasn't when I'd finished. While Harry talked, the head of E Branch studied him, but not so intently that he would notice. He seemed exactly the same man Clark had come to Edinburgh to see just a month ago, a visit which had ended for Clark in Rhodes and the islands of the Dodecanese, and for Harry in the mountains of Transylvania. He seemed the same. But was he? For the fact was, Darcy Clark knew someone who said he wasn't. Harry Keir was a composite. He was two men, the mind of one and the body of another. The mind was Keir and the body was, it had once been, Alec Kyle. And Clark had known Kyle too in his time. The strangest thing was this, that as time progressed, so the Kyle face and form got to look more like the old Harry, whose body was dead. But that was something which always made Clark's brain spin. He skipped it, put the metaphysical right out of his mind, and studied the purely physical. The necroscope was perhaps 43 or 4, but looked 5 years younger. But of course that was only the body. The mind was 5 years younger again. Even thinking about someone like Harry Keir was a weird business, and again Clark forced himself to concentrate on the physical. Harry's eyes were honey brown, occasionally defensive and frequently puppy soulful, or would be if one could see under those wedge-sided sunglasses he was wearing in the shade of his broad-brimmed 1930s hat. If there was one thing in all the world Clark hated to see, it had to be Harry wearing those dark-lensed glasses and that hat. Anyone else, no problem, but not Harry. and not now, especially the sunglasses. They were something Clark had told himself to look out for while it was a common enough thing to wear such in the Greek islands in late April or early May, it was quite another to see them in Edinburgh that time of year, unless someone had weak eyes, or different eyes. Grey streaks, so evenly spaced as to seem deliberately designed or affected, were plentiful in Harry's russet brown, naturally wavy hair. In a few years the grey would easily take over. Even now it loaned him a certain erudition, gave him the look of a scholar. A scholar, yes, but in what fabulous subjects. But in fact Keogh hadn't been like that at all. Hadn't used to be. What, Harry? A black magician? A warlock? Lord, no. Just a necroscope. A man who could talk to dead people. Keogh's body had been well-fleshed, maybe even a little overweight once. With his height, however, that ought not to have mattered a great deal. But it had mattered to Harry. After that business at the Chateau Brunetzi, his metempsychosis, he trained his new body down, brought it to a peak of perfection. Or at least done what he could with it, considering its age. That's why it looked only 37 or 38 years old. And inside Harry's body and behind his face, an innocent, or someone who used to be innocent. He hadn't asked to be the way he was, hadn't wanted to become E-Branch's most powerful weapon and do the things he'd done. But he'd been what he was, and the rest had come as a matter of course. And now, was he still an innocent? Did he still have the soul of a child? Did he have any soul at all? Or did something else have him? Now the pair had passed under the archway of the military guardroom, where several police officers had been interviewing a group of uniformed soldiers, into the cobbled gauntlet which was the approach alley to the castle proper. All the officers in the guardroom seemed aware that Clark was something big. They weren't challenged. Suddenly the bulk of the castle loomed before them. And now Darcy said, "So I don't need to do any tidying up. You left nothing undone, right?" "Nothing," Harry told him. "What about Janice's set-up in the islands?"
"Gone," said the other with finality. "All of it. All of them. But I still have a few men out there just looking, just to be on the safe side."
Harry's face was pale and grim, but he forced a strange, sad smile. "That's right, Darcy," he said. "Always be on the safe side. Never take chances, not with things like that." There was something in his voice. Clark looked at the necroscope out of the corner of his eye, carefully, unobtrusively examining him yet again as they entered the shade of a broad courtyard, with gaunt buildings rising on three sides.
"Are you going to tell me how it was?"
"No," Harry shook his head.
"Later, maybe. And maybe not."
He turned and looked Clark straight in the eyes.
"One vampire's pretty much like another. Hell, what can I tell you about them that you don't know already? You know how to kill them, that's a fact."
Clark stared directly into the black, enigmatic lenses of the other's glasses.
"You're the one who showed us how, Harry," he said.
Harry smiled his sad smile again, and apparently casually, but Clark suspected very deliberately, reached up a hand and took off his glasses. Not for a moment turning his face away, he folded the glasses and put them in his pocket. "And?" "Well," he said. Clark's jaw fell open as he backed off a stumbling pace, barely managing to contain the sigh of relief which he felt welling inside. Caught off balance again, he looked into the other's perfectly normal, unwavering brown eyes and said,
"Ah, what? Well?"
"Well, where are we going to start?" Harry answered with a shrug. "Or are we already there?" Clark gathered his wits.
"We're there," he said. "Almost."
He led the way down stone steps and under an arch, then through a heavy door into a stone-flagged corridor. As they emerged into the corridor, a military policeman came erect and saluted. Clark didn't correct his error, merely nodded, led Harry past him. Halfway along the corridor, a middle-aged man, unmistakably a policeman for all that he wore civilian clothing, guarded an iron-banded door of oak. Again Clark's nod, and the plainclothesman swung the door open for him and stepped aside. "Now we're there," Harry prompted Clark, causing him to close his mouth on those self-same words unspoken. Harry Keogh needed no one to tell him there was a dead person close by, and with one more glance at the necroscope, Clark ushered him inside. The officer didn't follow them but closed the door quietly behind them. The room was cool. Two walls were of natural stone. A rocky outcrop of volcanic gneiss grew out of the stone-flagged floor in one corner and into the walls there. Built straight into the rock, this place was a storeroom. Steel shelving was stacked on one side. On the other, beside the cold stone wall, a surgical trolley with a body on it and a white rubber sheet covering the body. The necroscope wasted no time. The dead held no terror for Harry Keogh. If he had as many friends among the living, then he'd be the most loved man in the world. He was the most loved man, but the ones who loved him couldn't tell anyone about it, except Harry himself. He went to the trolley, drew back the rubber sheet from the face, closed his eyes, and rocked back on his heels. She had been sweet and young and innocent, yes, another innocent. And she had been tormented. And she still was. Her eyes were closed now. But Harry knew that if they were open, he'd read terror in them. He could feel those dead eyes burning through the pale lids that covered them, crying out to him in their horror. She would need comforting. The teeming dead, the great majority, would have tried, but they didn't always get it right. Their voices were often mournful, ghostly, frightening to anyone who didn't know them. In the darkness of death, they could seem like night visitants, nightmares, like wailing banshees come to steal a soul. She might think she was dreaming, might even suspect that she was dying, but not that she was already dead. That took time to sink in, and the freshly dead were usually the last to know. That was because they were the least able to accept it, especially the very young, whose young minds had not yet properly considered it. But on the other hand, if she had actually seen death coming, if she had read it in the eyes of her destroyer, felt the numbing blow, or the hands on her throat, closing off the air, or the cutting edge of the instrument of her destruction, slicing into her flesh, then she would know. And she'd be cold and afraid and tearful. Tearful, yes, for no one knew better than Harry how the dead would cry. He hesitated, wasn't sure how best to approach her. Not even sure he would approach her, not now, for Harry knew that she'd been pure and that he was impure. True, her flesh was heading for corruption even now, but there's corruption and there's corruption. Angrily, he thrust the thought aside. No, he wasn't a defiler, not yet. He was a friend. He was the only friend. He was a necroscope. Be that as it may, when he put his hand on her clay-cold brow, she recoiled as from a serpent. Not physically, for she was dead, but her mind cringed, shrank down, withdrew into itself like the feathery fronds of some strange sea anemone brushed by a swimmer. Harry felt his blood turn to ice and for a moment stood in horror of himself. The last thing he wanted was to frighten her yet more. He wrapped her in his thoughts, in what had once been the warmth of his dead speak. "It's all right. Don't be afraid. I won't hurt you. No one can ever hurt you again." It was as easy as that. Without even trying, he'd told her that she was dead. But in the next moment, he knew that she had already known.
"Keep off!"
Her dead speak was a sobbing shriek of torment in Harry's mind.
"Get away from me, you filthy thing!"
As if someone had touched him with naked electric wires, Harry jerked where he stood beside her, jerked and shuddered as he relived, with her, the girl's last moments, her last living, breathing moments, but not the last things she had known. For in certain mercifully rare circumstances, and at the command of certain monstrous men, even dead flesh can be made to feel again. In a nightmarishly subliminal sequence, a series of flickering, kaleidoscopic, vividly ghastly pictures flashed on the screen of the necroscope's metaphysical mind and then was gone. But the after-images remained, and Harry knew that these wouldn't go away so easily. Indeed, that they would probably remain for a long time. He knew it as surely as he knew what he was dealing with, because he'd dealt with such a thing before. That one's name had been Dragusani. This poor girl's murderer had been like that, like Dragusani, a necromancer. But in one especially hideous respect, he'd been worse than that. For not even Dragusani had raped his corpse victims. "But it's over now," he told the girl. "He can't come back. You're safe now." He felt the shuddering of her thoughts receding, replaced by a natural curiosity of her incorporeal mind. She wanted to know him, but for the moment felt afraid to know anything. She wanted to know her condition, except that was probably the most frightening thing of all. But in her own small way she was brave, and she had to know for sure.
"Am I?"
Her dead-speak voice was no longer a shriek, but a shivery tremor.
"Am I really?"
"Yes, you are," Harry nodded, and knew that she'd sensed the movement even as all the teeming dead sensed his every mood and motion. "But," he stumbled, "I mean, it could be worse." He'd been through all this before, too often, and it never got any easier. How do you convince someone recently dead that it could be worse? Your body will rot and worms will devour it, but your mind will go on. Oh, you won't see anything. It will always be dark, and you'll never touch or taste or smell anything again. But it could be worse. Your parents and loved ones will cry over your grave and plant flowers there, seeking to visualize in their blooms something of your face and form. But you won't know they're there, or be able to speak to them and say, 'Here I am.' You won't be able to reassure them that it could be worse." This was Harry's expression of grief, meant to be private, but his thoughts were dead speak. She heard and felt them and knew him for a friend, and,
"You're the necroscope,"
she said then.
"They tried to tell me about you, but I was afraid and wouldn't listen. When they spoke to me, I turned away. I didn't want to talk to dead people."
Harry was crying. Great tears blurred his vision, rolled down his pale, slightly hollow cheeks, splashed hot where they fell on his hand, on her brow. He hadn't wanted to cry, didn't know he could, but there was that in him which worked on his feelings and amplified them, lifting them above the emotion of ordinary men. Safe, so long as it worked on an emotion such as this one, which was grief and entirely human. Darcy Clark had come forward. He touched the necroscope's arm.
"Harry?"
Harry shook him off, and his voice was choked but harsh too, as he rasped,
"Leave us alone! I want to talk to her in private!"
Clark backed off, his Adam's apple bobbing. It was the look on Harry's face that brought tears to his eyes too.
"Of course," he said.
He turned and left the room, and closed the door after him. Harry took a metal-framed chair from beside the stacked shelving and sat by the dead girl. He very carefully cradled her head in his arms.
I can feel that,"
she said, wonderingly.
"Then you can feel, too, that I'm not like him," Harry answered out loud.
He preferred simply to talk to the dead, for that way it came more naturally to him. Most of her terror had fled now. The necroscope was a comfort. He was warm, a safe haven. It might even be her father stroking her face, except she wouldn't be able to feel him. Only Harry Keogh could touch the dead. Only Harry and... Her terror welled up again, but he was quick to sense it and fend it off.
"It's over. You're safe. I won't let anything hurt you again, ever."
It was more than just a promise. It was his vow. In a little while her thoughts grew calm and she was easy, or easier again, but she was very bitter too, when she said,
"I'm dead, but that thing is alive."
"It's one of the reasons I'm here," Harry told her. "For you weren't the only one. There were others before you, and unless we stop him, there'll be others after you. You see, it's very important that we get him, for he's not just a murderer, but also a necromancer, which makes him more. Far worse than the sum of his parts. A murderer destroys the living, and a necromancer torments the dead. but this one enjoys the terror of his victims both before and after they die.
I can't talk about what he did to me,
she said, shuddering. Harry shook his head. You don't have to. Right now, I'm only interested in you. I'm sure there'll be people worrying about you. Until we know who you are, we won't be able to put their minds at rest.
Do you think their minds will ever be at rest, Harry?
It was a good question. We won't have to tell them everything, he answered. I might be able to fix it so that they only know, well, that someone killed you. They don't have to be told how.
Can you do that?
If that's the way you want it, he said.
Then do it.
She offered a breathless sigh.
That was the worst, Harry. Thinking about them, my folks, how they'd take it. But if you can make it easier for them... I think I'm beginning to understand why the dead love you so. My name is Penny, Penny Sanderson, and I lived at...
And so it went. She told the necroscope all about herself, and he remembered every smallest detail. That was what Darcy Clark had wanted, but it wasn't everything he'd wanted. When finally Penny Sanderson was through, Harry knew he still had to take her that one step further. Penny, listen, he said. I don't want you to do or say anything. Don't try to talk to me at all. But like I said before, this is important.
About him?
Penny, when I first touched you, and you thought it was him come back for more, you remembered how it was? Parts of it, anyway. You thought about it in brief flashes of memory. It was dead speak, and I picked it up, but it was all very chaotic, kaleidoscopic.
But that's all there is, she said. That's how it was.
Harry nodded. Okay, that's fine, but I need to see it again. See, the better I remember it, the more chance I have of finding him. So really you don't have to tell me anything, not as a conscious act. I just want to shoot a few words at you, at which you'll picture the bits I need. Do you understand?
Word association?
Something like that, yes. Except, of course, in this case, the association will be hell for you, but easier than just talking about it. She understood. Harry sensed her willingness. Before she could change her mind, he said, Knife. A picture hit the screen of his mind like a mixture of blood and acid. The blood incensed him and the acid burned, etching the picture there for good this time. Harry reeled before her horror, which was unbearable, and if he hadn't been seated, would have fallen. The shock was that physical, even though it lasted only a fraction of a second. When she stopped sobbing, he said, Are you okay?
No. Yes.
Face, Harry fired at her.
Face?
His face, he tried again. A face, red, leering, bloated with lust, with an open, salivating mouth and eyes, insensate as frozen diamonds, went skittering across the necroscope's mind's eye. But not so fast that he didn't catch it, and this time she wasn't sobbing. She wanted this to work, wanted him brought to justice. Where? A picture of a car park, a motorway restaurant. Darkness pierced with points of light, a string of cars and lorries speeding down three lanes with oncoming lights whose glare momentarily blinded, and windscreen wipers swinging left, right, left, right, left. But there was no pain in the last, and Harry guessed that wasn't where it had happened. No, it had been where it started to happen, probably where she met him. He picked you up in a car. A rain-blurred picture of an ice-blue screen with white letters superimposed or printed there, F-R-I-D, Frid, or F-R-I-G, Frig. The screen had many wheels and puffed exhaust smoke. It was the way she remembered it. A large vehicle, a lorry, articulated. Penny, Harry said, I have to do this, only this time I don't mean where you met him.
Where?
Ice, bitter, cold, dark, the whole place softly vibrating or throbbing, and dead things everywhere, hanging from hooks. Harry tried to fix it all in his mind, but nothing was clear, only her shock and disbelief that this was happening to her. She was sobbing again, terrified, and Harry knew that he'd soon have to stop. He couldn't bring himself to hurt her any more, but at the same time he knew he mustn't weaken now. Death, he snapped, hating himself. And it was the knife scene all over again, and Harry knew he was losing her, could feel her withdrawing before that could happen. And afterwards, God, he didn't want to know. He didn't want to know. Penny Sanderson screamed and screamed and screamed. But the necroscope got his picture and wished he hadn't bothered. Chapter 2. Upon Their Backs to Bite 'em. Harry stayed with her for a further half hour, calming, soothing, doing what he could, and in so doing managing to get a few more personal details out of her, enough to give the police something to go on anyway. And when it was time to go, she wouldn't let him, without him promising he'd see her again. She hadn't been there long, but already Penny had discovered that death was a lonely place. The necroscope was jaded, or thought he was, by life, death, everything. He believed he needed motivation. Before leaving her, he asked if she'd mind if he looked at her. She told him that if it were anyone else, she couldn't care less, because she wouldn't even know they were looking, not any longer. But with Harry, she would know, because he was a necroscope. She was just a shy kid. Hey, he protested, but gently. I'm no voyeur.
If I wasn't, if he hadn't, if I was unmarked, then I don't think I'd mind, she said.
Penny, you're lovely, Harry told her. And me? After all said and done, I'm only human. But believe me, I'm not putting you down when I tell you that right now that I'm not interested in that side of things. It's because you're marked that I want to see you. I need to feel angry. And now that I know you, I know that to see what he did would make me feel angry.
Then I'll just have to pretend you're my doctor, she said.
Harry very gently took the rubber sheet off her pale young body, looked at her, and tremblingly put the sheet back again.
Is it bad?
She fought down a sob.
It's such a shame. Mum always said I could be a model.
So you could, he told her. You were very beautiful.
But now?
And though she kept from actually sobbing, he could feel her despair brimming over. But in a little while she said,
Harry, did it make you angry?
He felt a growl rising in his throat, suppressed it, and before he left her said, Oh yes, yes it did. Darcy Clark was still outside the door with the plain clothesman. Looking washed out, Harry joined them and closed the door after him. I've left the sheet off her face, he said, and then speaking specifically to and glaring at the officer, Don't cover her face. The other raised an indifferent eyebrow and shrugged. Who, me? He said, his accent nasal, Glaswegian, less than sympathetic.
I had nothing to do with that, Chief. It's just that when they're deadens, people usually cover them up.
Harry turned swiftly towards him, eyes widening and nostrils flaring in his pale, grimacing face, and Darcy Clark's instinct took over. The necroscope was suddenly dangerous, and Clark's weird talent knew it. There was a terrible anger in him, which he needed to take out on someone. But Clark knew that it wasn't directed at him, wasn't directed at anyone, but simply required an outlet. Quickly forcing himself between Harry and the special duty officer, he grabbed the necroscope's arm.
It's okay, Harry, he said urgently. It's okay. It's just that these people see things like this all the time. It doesn't affect them so much. They get used to it.
Harry got a grip of himself, but not without an effort of will. He looked at Clark and growled. They don't see things like that all the time. No one's ever going to get used to the idea that someone something could do that to a girl. And then seeing Clark's bewildered expression,
I'll explain later.
He turned his gaze across Clark's shoulder, and in a tone more nearly civil now, more civilized, asked the officer, Do you have a notebook? Mystified, not knowing what was going on, just trying to do his job, the other said,
Aye?
And groped in his pocket. He scribbled down as Harry fired Penny's name, address, and family details at him. following which, and looking even more mystified,
"You're sure about these details, sir?"
Harry nodded. "Just be sure to pass on what I said, right? I don't want anyone to cover her face over." Penny always hated having her face covered.
"You knew the young lady, then?"
"No," said Harry. "Now I know her." They left the officer talking into his walkie-talkie and scratching his head, went up into the courtyard and the fresh air. As they moved into the sunlight, Harry put on his dark glasses and turned up the collar of his coat, and Clark said to him, "You've got something else, right?" Harry nodded, but in the next moment, "Never mind what I got. What have you got? Do you have any idea what you're dealing with?" Clark threw up his hands.
"Only that he's a serial killer, and that he's weird."
"But you know what he does?"
Clark nodded.
"Yes, we know it's sexual, a sort of sex anyway, a sick sort of sex."
Harry shivered.
"Sicker than you think. Dragasani's kind of sickness."
That pulled Clark up short.
"What?"
"A necromancer," Harry told him. "A murderer and a necromancer. And in a way worse than Dragasani, because this one's a necrophiliac too." Charles somehow succeeded in grimacing and looking blank at the same time. Then, "Refresh my mind," he said. "I know I should be getting something, but I'm not." Harry thought about it for a few moments before answering, but in the end there was no way to tell it other than the way it was. "Dragasani tore open the bodies of dead men for information," he finally said. "That was his talent, just like you have yours and I have mine. Necromancy. It was his job when he worked for Gregor Borowitz and Soviet E branch at the Chateau Brunetzi to examine the corpses of his country's enemies. He could read their passions in the mucus of their eyes, tear the truth of their lives right out of their streaming tripes, tune in on the whisperings of their stiffening brains, and sniff their smallest secrets in the gases of their swollen guts." Clark held up a hand in protest.
"Christ, Harry, I know all that."
The necroscope nodded.
"But you don't know what it's like to be dead, and that's why you're not getting it. It's because you can't imagine what I'm talking about. You know what I do and accept it because you know it for a fact, but deep inside yourself you still think it's just too way out to think about. So you don't. And I don't blame you. Now listen, I know I was protested I was different from Dragasani, but in certain ways he and I were alike. Even now I don't like admitting it, but it's true. I mean, you know what the bastard did to Keenan Gormley? The mess he made of him? But only I knew what Gormley thought about it."
And now Clark got it. He snatched air in a great gasp and felt the short hairs stiffening at the back of his neck as an irrepressible shudder racked his body. And,
"Jesus, you're right," he breathed. "I just don't think about it because I don't want to think about it. And in fact, Keenan knew. He felt everything Dragasani did to him."
"Right." Harry was relentless. "Torture is the necromancer's principal tool. The dead feel the necromancer working on them just like they hear me talking to them, except unlike the living, there's nothing they can do about it, not even scream. Not and be heard, anyway. And Penny Sanderson?" Clark went pale in a moment.
"She could feel
everything," Harry growled.
"And that bastard, whoever he is, knew it. So you see, while rape is one thing, and bad enough when it's done to the living, and while necrophilia is something else, an outrage carried out upon the unfeeling dead, what he does hits new lows. He tortures his victims alive, then tortures them dead. And he knows while he's doing it that they can feel it. He uses a knife with a curved blade, like a tool for scooping earth when you're planting bulbs. It's razor sharp, and he doesn't use it for scooping earth."
It had been Clark's intention to stop at the guardroom and speak to the policeman there, but now, pale as a ghost, he reeled to the castle's low wall. Clutching its masonry for support, he gulped at the gusting air and fought down the bile he felt rising from the churning of his guts. And,
"Jesus,"
he choked, for he could see it all now, and there was nothing he could do to cleanse the picture from his mind's eye. Weird sex. God, what an understatement. Harry had followed Clark to the wall. The head of E branch looked at him sideways from a watery eye.
He digs holes in those poor kids, then makes love to the holes.
Love, the necroscope hissed. His flesh ruts in blood like a pig's snout ruts in soil, Darcy, except the soil can't feel. Didn't the police tell you where he leaves his semen?
Clark's eyes were swimming and his brow feverish, but he felt his nausea being replaced by a cold loathing almost as strong as the necroscope's own.
No, the police hadn't told him that, but now he knew. He looked out over the blurred city and asked, "How do you know he knows they feel it?"
"Because he talks to them while he's doing it," Harry told him mercilessly. "And when they cry out in their agony and beg him to stop, he hears them, and he laughs."
Clark thought, "Christ, I shouldn't have asked. And you bastard, Harry Keogh, you shouldn't have told me."
With fury in his eyes, he turned to face the necroscope and face thin air. A wind blew up the esplanade and tourists leaned into it, balancing themselves. Overhead, seagulls cried where they spiraled on rising thermals, but Harry was no longer there. Later, with Clark's help, Harry fixed it that Penny Sanderson would be cremated. Her parents wanted it, and it wouldn't hurt them that it was all a show. They wouldn't know it anyway, that Penny was already ashes when their tears fell on her empty box, before it slid away from them behind swishing curtains and became wood smoke. Clark hadn't wanted to do it, but he owed Harry for a good many things, and he wanted very badly to catch the maniac who had done this thing to Penny and too many other innocents. Harry had told him, "If I have her ashes, her pure ashes, not damaged or spoiled by burned linen or charcoal, then I'll be able to talk to her any time I want to, and maybe she'll remember something important." It had seemed logical at the time, if anything about the necroscope could ever seem logical, and so Clark had pulled strings. As the head of E branch, he had that sort of power. But if he'd known the whole story of what had happened at the castle of Janos Forenzi in Transylvania, maybe he would have thought twice about it, and then not done it at all. He certainly wouldn't have gone along with it if Zeg Fona had stood firm on her first accusation, or if not accusation, a premonition at least. Zeg was a telepath and as loyal to the necroscope as they came. In the Greek islands at the end of the Forenzi business, she'd had occasion to try and contact Harry with her mind, during the course of which something had shocked her rigid, but it had been a while before she could tell Clark what it was. They had been on the island of Rhodes at the time, less than a month ago, and their conversation was still fresh in his mind. "What is it, Zeg?" he'd said to her, when he could talk to her in private. "I saw that change come over your face when you contacted Harry. Is he in some sort of trouble?"
"No. Yes. I don't know," she answered,
fear and frustration audible in her every word, visible in her every move. Then she'd looked at him and it was that same strange disbelieving look he'd seen when she tried to contact Harry, as if she'd gazed on alien things in a distant world beyond the times and places we know. And he remembered that indeed she had once been in such a world with Harry Keogh, a world of vampires. "Zeg," he'd said then, "if there's something I should know about Harry, it's only fair that..."
"Only fair to who?" she had cut him off. "To whom? To what? And is it fair to him?"
At which Clark had felt an icy chill in his blood, and,
"I think you'd better explain," he said.
"I can't explain," she snapped at him. "Well, maybe I can."
And then the empty expression in her beautiful eyes had filled itself in a little, and her tone had become more reasonable, even pleading.
"It's just that every other mind I have touched in the last few days has seemed to be one of them. So maybe I've started to find them where there aren't any, where they can't possibly be."
And then he'd known for certain what she was trying to tell him.
"You meant that when you contacted Harry, you sensed..."
"Yes, yes," she snapped again. "But I could be mistaken. I mean, isn't that what he's doing at this very moment, going up against them? He's close to vampires right now, even as we talk. It could be one of them, I sensed. God, it has to be one of them."
End of conversation, but it hadn't been out of Clark's mind from that day to this.
When it was time to leave the islands and come home again, he had asked Zek if she'd like to visit England as a guest of E-Branch. Her answer had been more or less what he'd expected.
"You're not fooling anyone, Darcy. And anyway, I don't like the idea that you would want to fool me, not after all of this. So I'll tell you straight out, I detest E-Branches, whether they're Russian, British, whoever they belong to. No, not the Espers themselves, but the way they're used, the fact that they need to be used at all. As for Harry, I won't go up against the Necroscope."
And she'd given her head a very definite shake.
"We were on different sides once before, Harry and me, and he gave me some good advice. Never again go up against me or mine, he said, and I never will. I've seen inside his mind, Darcy, and I know that when someone like Harry says something like that to you, you'd better listen to him. So if there are problems, well, they're your problems, not mine."
It had been the kind of answer to make him worry all the more. Back in London after the Greek expedition at E-Branch headquarters, a mass of work had built up. During the first 4 days back at his desk, Clark had cleared, or at least commenced to clear, quite a lot of it, also managed to clear his mind of much of the horror of the forensy job. But the nightmares kept him awake most nights. One in particular was very bad and very persistent. This was the essence of it. They, Clark, Zek, Jazz Simmons, Ben Trask, Manolis Papastomas, most of the Greek team, with the important exception of Harry Keogh, were in a boat that lolled gently on an absolutely flat ocean. It was so blue, that sea, that it could only be the Aegean. A small, stark, sloping island of rock floating on the blue made a gold-rimmed black silhouette against the blinding refraction of a half-sun, where it prepared to dip down beyond the slanting rock of the island into a short-lived twilight. The serenity of the scene was immaculately structured, vivid, real, with nothing in it to hint that it was a prelude to nightmare. But since the thing was recurrent, indeed a nightly occurrence, Clark always knew what was coming and where to look for the start of it. He would look at Zek, gorgeous in her swimsuit that left little to the imagination, stretched out along a narrow sunbathing platform attached to the upper strakes of the stern. She lay on her stomach, her face turned sideways, with one hand dangling in the water, and the sea so calm that her fingers made ripples. But then she glanced sharply at her hand in the water, snatched it out and stared at it, gave a cry of disgust, and tumbled herself inboard. Her hand was red, bleeding. No, not bleeding, but bloody, as if it had been dipped into someone else's blood. By which time the entire crew had seen that the sea itself was sullied by a great crimson swathe, an elongated splotch like an oil slick, a blood slick, which had drifted to surround the boat with its thick red ribbons. But drifted from where? They looked out across the sea, followed the swathe to its source. Previously unnoticed, the warty, barnacled prow of a sunken vessel stuck up in a grotesque salute from the water only 50 yards away. Its figurehead was a hideous but recognizable face, mouth gaping, hugely disproportionate fangs jutting, and blood spewing in an unending torrent from the silently shrieking mouth. And the vessel's name? As she gurgled down at the sight of her own blood. Clark didn't need to read all of those black letters daubed on her scabby hull as they disappeared, in reverse order, one by one into the crimson ocean. O-R-C-E-N. No, for he already knew that this was the plague ship, Necroscope, out of Edinburgh, contaminated in strange ports of call and doomed forever to oceans of gore, or until, like now, she sank. Aghast, he watched her go down, then jumped to his feet as Papastomas cursed and leapt to snatch up a spear gun. The swathe of blood beside the boat was bubbling, fuming, as some nameless thing drifted to the surface. A body, naked face down, floated up and lolled like some weird jellyfish, dangling its tentacle arms and legs, and feebly as a jellyfish it tried to swim. Then Papastomas was at the side of the boat, aiming his gun, and Clark was starting forward, screaming, "No!" But too late. The steel spear hissed through the air and thwacked into the lone survivor's back, and he jerked in the water and rolled over. and his face was the face on the figurehead, and his scarlet eyes glared, and his scarlet mouth belched blood as he sank down out of sight for the last time. Which was when Clark would start awake. He started now as his telephone chirped, then sighed his relief that his morbid chain of thoughts had been broken. He let the telephone chirp away to itself for a few moments and considered his nightmare in the light of cold logic. Clark was no honoromancer, but the dream's interpretation seemed simple enough. Zek, to her own dismay, had pointed the finger of suspicion at Harry. As for the Aegean backdrop and the blood, these were hardly inappropriate in the circumstances and considering the occurrences of the recent past. And the dream's conclusion? Papastomus had put an end to the horror. But that wasn't significant, hadn't been the point of it. It didn't have to be Papastomus, but could have been any one of them, except Clark himself. That had been the point of it, that Darcy Clark himself hadn't done it and didn't want it to happen. In fact, he had tried to stop it. Just like right now, he was less than eager to start anything. The telephone was starting in on its fifth repeat performance when he reached for it, but the relief he'd felt at the first chirp was short-lived. His nightmare was right there on the other end of the wire.
Darcy?
The necroscope's voice was calm, collected, about as detached as Clark had ever heard it.
Harry?
Clark pressed a button on his desk, ensuring the conversation could be recorded, and another which alerted the switchboard to commence a trace.
I thought I might hear from you before now.
Oh, why?
Harry asked good questions, and this one stopped Clark dead, for after all, E-Branch didn't own Harry Keogh.
Why? He thought quickly. Because of your interest in the serial killer case. I mean, it's been 10 days since we met in Edinburgh. We've spoken only once since then. I suppose I'd been hoping you'd come up with something pretty quick.
And your people?
Harry returned.
Your espers? Have they come up with anything? Your telepaths and hunchmen? Spotters, precogs and locators? Have the police come up with anything? No, they haven't, because if they had, you wouldn't be asking me. Hey, I'm only one man, Darcy. And you have a whole gang.
Clark decided to play the other at his own circuitous game.
Okay, so tell me, to what do I owe the pleasure, Harry? I can't believe it's a social call.
The necroscope's chuckle, normal, however dry, brought a little more relief to it.
You make a good sparring partner,
he said.
Except you cry uncle too quick.
And before Clark could counter, he went on,
I need some information, Darcy. That's why I'm calling.
Who am I talking to? Clark wondered. What am I talking to? God, if only I could be sure it was Harry. I mean, all you, just you. But I can't be sure. And if it's not all you, then sooner or later it will be my job to do something about it.
Which, of course, was what his nightmare was all about. But out loud he only said,
Information? How can I help you?
Two things,
Harry told him.
The first one's a big one. Details of other murdered girls. Oh, I know I could get them for myself. I have friends in the right places, right? But this time I prefer not to put the teeming dead to the trouble.
Oh?
Clark was curious. Suddenly Harry sounded cagey. Put the great majority to trouble? But the dead would do anything for the necroscope, even rise from their graves.
We've asked enough of the dead.
Harry tried to explain himself, almost as if he'd read Clark's mind.
Now it's time we did them a few favours.
Still puzzled, Clark said,
Give me half an hour, and I'll duplicate everything we have for you. I can mail it, or... But no, that would be silly. You can simply pick it up yourself, right here.
Again, Harry chuckled.
You mean via the Mobius Continuum? What, and set off all those alarms again?
He stopped, chuckling.
No, mail it,
he said.
You know, I'm not stuck on that place of yours. You espers, give me the shivers.
Clark laughed out loud. It was forced laughter, but he hoped the other wouldn't notice.
And what's the other thing I can do for you, Harry?
That's easy,
said the necroscope.
You can tell me about Paxton.
It was delivered like a bolt out of the blue and quite deliberately.
Pah!
The smile slid from Clark's face, was replaced by a frown. Paxton. What about Paxton? He didn't know anything about him, only that he'd done a few months probation as an Esper, a telepath, and that the minister responsible had found cause to reject him. Something about a couple of small kinks in his past record, apparently.
Yes, Paxton,
Harry said again.
Geoffrey Paxton. He's one of yours, isn't he?
There was an edge to his voice now, an almost mechanical precision which was cold and controlled, like a computer waiting for some vital item of information before it could commence its calculations.
Was, Clark finally answered. Was going to be one of ours, yes. But it seems he had a couple of black marks against him and so missed the boat.
How do you know about him anyway? Or more to the point, what do you know about him?
Darcy.
The edge on Harry's voice was sharpened. It wasn't menacing, there was no threat to it, no way, but still Clark could sense its warning.
We've been friends of sorts for a long time. I've stuck my neck out for you, you've stuck yours out for me. I'd hate to think you were shafting me now.
Shafting you? Clark's answer was instinctive, natural, even mildly affronted. With every right, for he wasn't hiding anything or shafting anyone. I don't even know what you're talking about. It's like I said, Geoffrey Paxton is a middling telepath, but developing rapidly. Or he was, then we lost him. Our minister found something he didn't like, and Paxton was out. Without us, he won't ever be able to develop his full potential. We'll give him the once-over now and then, just to make sure he's not using what he has to take too much advantage of society. But apart from that...
But he's already taking advantage.